On this episode, we discuss Gotti.
Forget about it.
I feel like it doesn't get better than that.
Everyone, and welcome to the Flophouse. I'm Dan McCoy.
Hey, I'm Stuart over here. Stuart Wellington, that is.
And I'm Elliot Kalin, Ellie Bag of Donuts. Yeah, from the block. Yeah, one of the boys.
As you can tell from our period-appropriate and region-appropriate accents, we're talking about the movie Gotti today on the Flophouse.
That's right, because what do we do on this podcast, Dan?
Wow, we're really getting into it fast this time. Mm-hmm. Okay, we watch a bad movie.
Oh, sorry, Dan, should we dilly-dally more? How was your guys' weekend?
I mean, usually we dick around a little bit.
How much trampolining did you do this weekend? Because I did a fair amount.
Uh-huh. I would say I spent zero trampolining, hours trampolining.
Is trampolining like a new thing kids are doing?
Yeah, yeah. It's a slang innuendo for jumping on a trampoline.
Oh, wow. Okay. Cool.
Hey, guys, how many times did a four-year-old boy demand you play a Monty Python-based card game with him?
I don't know. Not.
Because that is, can you that is the new...
Describe the mechanics to me, please.
Well, it's a variant of the game Flux. So okay. It's a card game in which the goal and the rules of the game are changing, and you want to collect certain items that match a goal card as long as that goal card is in play. This is a game that was gifted to me. I know certain people hate the word gifted that use that way, but I don't care, whatever. Shakespeare made up words all the time. Gifted to me by my wife, and we said to my son, it says on the box it's for ages 13 and up, so it might be a little complicated for you. We'll play this with you another time. Instead, my son absorbed the rules as if by osmosis almost instantly and loves the game and wants to play it constantly. And so anytime he is not like in the bath or in the car or eating, he's like, Monty Python, Monty Python, let's play Monty Python. Yeah. Daddy, can you guess what I'm thinking right now? Monty Python. Hey, Daddy, I'm thinking of a game that starts with M, Monty Python. And we played it three times this morning.
Elliot?
And he beats me one-third to two-thirds of the time we play.
Elliot, you can't see because your camera's off, but I'm crying right now.
We've said to him, we're like, Stuart's going to be very happy to play a game with you someday, Sam. Stuart, I've been talking to him a lot about you because he seems to grasp game mechanics very quickly, and he's all about games. And it's worrying me a little bit because he started designing what he calls a murder world, where he wants to put people through what he calls games with the ultimate risk and the ultimate penalty.
I don't know. He's already got the tagline on the box ready.
And he started building a prototype with his Legos, and I mean, it seems like it works pretty well. Nobody's seen the mailman in a few days.
I mean, I feel like the game with the ultimate risk and ultimate penalty was already designed, and it's called Don't Break the Ice.
Oh, I would think it was Don't Wake Daddy, because the secret was Daddy, he's an alcoholic.
Yeah, you don't want to wake him. He has rage issues.
Now, on the other hand,
well, Elliot,
crackers in my
so
bed,
nice to
not
hear
so bad.
You describe how to play a game. Usually, shoes on the other foot for me, and I have to describe a game to you or Dan to various levels of complaining.
I don't know. I wouldn't say complaining. Maybe glazed disinterest.
Yeah.
Okay.
The last time Dan came over for a game night, every time it was his turn, he let out the most audible sigh. It was amazing. And then he did the best out of everybody. So, you know.
I mean, well, that's Dan at this point. The sigh doesn't really mean what we think it means. He's more sigh than man at this point.
Yeah.
And the sigh is just the way he interacts with the universe. Okay. That being said, Dan, rather than give you a chance to counteract that, let's cut the shit, okay? No offense. Let's guys, we got real family business to deal with around here. Top business. Because Dan, what do we do on this La Pod Nostra Crostra of ours?
Well, we said it already. We watch a bad movie and then we talk about it.
I couldn't remember because the dilly dally.
This week, Dan,
we watched Gotti.
We watched Gotti, okay. Starring Johnny Travolta.
Johnny Travolta as Johnny Gotti. That's right, John Gotti, the Teflon Don, the Dapper Don, Donald Duck, Don Johnson.
I guess that's fair.
He had a penis. Prove me wrong, Stuart.
Okay, wait. I got to do the math. Wow, it checks out.
Now, Gotti had it was in the 2018 Hall of Shame as it topped the list of many people's worst movies of the year. Do we feel the same way? Well, let's just say that it was directed by E from the Entourage TV show and
Holy shit, that's who it was?
Yes.
I knew I recognized that fucking name, but I didn't know.
Mm-hmm. After many years being attached as a possible Barry Levinson project, this book was finally handed into the equivalent hands of E from Entourage, whose name I can't remember. I'm sure he's a fine human being. I don't know. But it seems like he was not as up to the task as, say, Barry Levinson. Now, let's say one thing about Gotti. This movie wants to be Goodfellas so badly.
Yeah.
Like, it so wants to be Goodfellas. Everything about it is aping Goodfellas. And I think it's missing out on what, just to spoil it, it misses out on the main point of Goodfellas, which is that the mafia life is very seductive for good reasons, but it's also very self-destructive and it will ruin your life.
Whereas it feels like somebody watched only watched Goodfellas once while it was screening on like TBS and, yeah. and missed the end of it.
They watched the first half of it and then got a phone call and all they saw were helicopters and him getting a nice new house at the end. And yeah. They were like, this looks pretty cool. Because this movie is about how the mafia life is very seductive because it's great. And sometimes you meet really wonderful people like John Gotti.
Yeah.
Now, guys, going into this movie, what was your level of knowledge about John Gotti?
I knew he was a mafia kingpin.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And that was it. I was pretty sure he was dead.
Okay. And Stuart, similar?
Yeah. I mean, I watched this movie with my wife, who had a much larger knowledge base of John Gotti, having grown up and lived all her life in Brooklyn.
Yes. Now, because this movie really seems to assume a very large amount of knowledge about John Gotti and his life on the part of the viewer, and also a real desire to connect with John Gotti. There are scenes that come up in the movie where you're supposed to be like, oh, this is what's going to happen. And I was like, and so they'd mention people's names and I'd be like, okay, who? What? Like there's a bunch of scenes where they're just mentioning the names of other real life mobsters. And it was like, at this point, and this is what it must feel like when I'm talking about Star Wars in front of certain people, where I'm just like, oh yeah, yeah. Well, you got Moma Nadon and you got Ponda Baba. And they're just like, syllables. Yes. That's what some of the scenes in this movie felt like.
This movie loves to introduce new characters. Loves it.
And it's a mix of that. You know, an almost William Gibson-esque disregard to people's knowledge of the situation. And but also there will be scenes where they'll explain everything so explicitly that you're like, Stacey Keach, John Gotti would know the names of the five different boroughs of New York. You don't have to explain it in the greatest scene in the movie.
Oh, that movie is where John Gotti, well, just skipping ahead, John Gotti is plotting to murder his own mob boss. And he's talking to the underboss played by Stacey Keach. And Stacey Keach goes, you're going to have the heads of all five families and the heads of all five boroughs. Manhattan, Brooklyn, the Bronx, Queens, Staten Island, and John Gotti is absorbing this information like a Padawan at the feet of a Jedi Master. And you're like, you think it would be shorthand, he would understand. But okay, so let's start with the movie. We open, John Gotti is standing next to, which bridge was that? Was that the 59th Street Bridge? Or the Manhattan Bridge? He's standing next to a bridge in New York.
This is an important detail for us to get correct, or else people will disregard our opinion of the movie.
I know. They'll be like, that was the right bridge. But it looks as if he just whacked Woody Allen and Annie Hall and is standing next to the bridge they were looking at. But he addresses the camera and he talks about how he's from New York and he made it big. He started from the gutter and he made it big. And then he says what I thought was maybe the funniest line in the movie.
Oh, I love this life line.
This life ends in one of two ways, dead or in jail. I did both. And it's like, dude, everyone does both if they go to jail. Because it's not like there's a mob boss who's been in jail for 200 years.
Well, it's also like the Grim Reaper,
it's not a Final Destination scenario where the Grim Reaper wants to steal the soul of Sam the Chin Gigante, but Sam's in jail and he's like, dast, these bars will stop my skeletal fingers.
Yeah, but his scythe keeps setting off the metal detector. And so he has to like bake it. In a cake.
He tries to sneak in his sight through a cake and they're like, oh, nope. Try again. Try again, embodiment of the abstract notion of death and unbeing. Yep.
You did not nail it.
Dan? Sorry. No, he's talking to Sammy.
It's fine. You can think of me as your son.
I do, kind of. I already do.
It's also wrong in another way, which is there's one way that life ends and it's in death.
Uh-huh.
It's not like... the other option is jail. It's like, I pick jail, where I will live forever.
Uh-huh.
Well, he's talking about, you know, the life, the mob life. So anyway, we cut to 1973, and Gotti is...
And also, we have to point out that in that opening sequence, and like much of this movie, John Travolta's wearing, like, the actual clothes of John Gotti. He had gotten a lot of John Gotti's actual wardrobe to wear during this film.
I didn't realize that. Because the movie, it is based on the memoirs of John Gotti's son, John Jr.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't realize that. So he's wearing John Gotti's suits. Is that why he felt the need to put on strangely varying amounts of makeup at different points, depending on the age he thinks John Gotti's supposed to be? Because... just to spoil something, he has some of the worst old age makeup I've seen in a long time. It's like he saw Guy Pearce in Prometheus and was like, "I can do better. I can outdo that." But when he's playing old John Gotti, he's wearing such heavy makeup. Mm-hmm. I thought he was supposed to be 95 years old, and then I looked up John Gotti at the end. They say John Gotti dead at the age of 61. I was like, "Wait a minute!" I looked up John Travolta is older than 61 right now. So I guess they had to make him look older than he is now. So they made him look like an elderly, like a mummy.
I mean, I guess he had been like going through cancer treatment, maybe. So maybe, I mean,
maybe. It usually doesn't make you look elderly. I don't know.
It's great that they go so overboard with his old age makeup, but for the actor who plays John Gotti Jr., the only nods to age changes are his hair is slicked down when he's younger, it's straight up when he's older, and I think he has a little bit of gray on the sides, J. Jonah Jameson style at the end.
And he wears glasses. They put glasses on him. There's a so John Jr. is played by this guy who must be 21 years old through the whole movie, and there's a part at the end where he's saying goodbye to his family, and his kids are all like 8, 10 years old. And I was like, wait, are these his younger brothers? Like, hold on a second. He does not, it looks like, are these friends of his that he brought home from school? They're on a sleepover with him. It's hilarious. And so to make John Travolta look younger when he's young John Gotti, they just make his hair so black. It's like gravity can't escape, the light can't escape the gravity of his hair. It's so mm-hmm. black. But anyway,
yeah.
So it's 1973, and young John Gotti, he's heading a team for Carlo Gambino of the Gambino crime family to find a kidnapper who kidnapped somebody. I guess Carlo's son, I'm not sure. It's like, why'd they choose John Gotti to do it? Who knows? The next scene, they're in a bar, the kidnapper's there, they shoot him in the head as Smoke on the Water plays. How do they find him? Who knows? Who cares? He's John Gotti. He's just good at that stuff. And now, he's a made man. Cut to, he's an old man in jail. Again, looks like he should be guarding the one true grail mm-hmm. in a cave somewhere so that Donovan can't drink the life of eternal youth from it.
Yeah, and instead he should just pick the right Pepsi, right? That's the thing. Like, if you pick the wrong Pepsi, your face melts.
Yeah, I think that's how those commercials used to work. Yeah. He's recovering from cancer, and he tells his son, John Jr., who again looks like he's about 15 years old, although he is playing the married father head of a mob family, not to take a plea deal because that's the coward's way out. Cut back to him in jail as a young dad. He won't let his son be a cop for Halloween, and we get to see him and his wife. And he and his wife are like an SNL version of a mob couple. Mm-hmm. They are, and it's his real life wife, right?
Yeah, that's Kelly Preston. And I believe that I believe that scene, if it was a sketch on Saturday Night Live, it would have been titled "What's a Matter with You?"
And they would have hosted a show from their wood paneled basement, about what's going on in on the block in the neighborhood. But there, it's like the Boston sketch from SNL where they're the Bostonians, like is a scene of restrained character work compared to the arguments. And at this point, the movie is just ping ponging back and forth between the present and the past, or I guess the future, the not as distant past and the very distant past, in a way that I think is supposed to, again, set up thematic lessons like Goodfellas does, but instead it feels like a quilt, like a crazy quilt, the craziest of quilts.
And you're talking about the Batman villain, not the hired gun card from the Doomtown collectible card game.
You read my mind, Stuart.
It's also very confusing, the time jumps, because there will be like scenes within like the same year where like, I was watching this with a friend, and she kept being like, "How much time has passed? How much time has passed?" Like, because there'd be scenes between the same year where like you have no idea, and then there would be like title cards occasionally that would tell you the year.
Mm-hmm.
But then there would be like title cards that would tell you the year, and it was the same year as it was the last time they told you the year. Mm-hmm. Like they're like yeah. five ones that said 1985. I'm like, okay, great, thanks.
Yeah, when, so was still... there a fucking sale on 1985 title cards?
Some of these 1985 title cards are just not moving the way they used to. We'll put a bulk discount on them. It's a movie that it has some storytelling issues. Yeah, Dan, let's put a positive spin on it and say that it always keeps the audience on their toes. It's okay. a movie that yeah. challenges you to really pay attention to catch all the clues. It feels like
a fragmented
before
portrait.
And those, yeah. The keeping the audience on their toes is a good choice of words, Elliot, because it was around now in the movie where we have a scene where the character John Travolta is talking to other mafioso guys, and they're just like standing out in the street, and they're using terms that incensed my wife because she had to jump up, stop the movie, and explain to me that there is no way that mafia guys would stand around referring to things as the mafia and specific family names.
I mean, the fact that La Cosa Nostra is literally the code word for the mafia because they don't want to say mafia. That yeah, they all have that. The fact that like we were saying, it's a movie that will withhold special information like who is John Gotti and where did he come from and why is he doing this. But then it will spoon feed you the idea that like there's a family called the Gambino family. Okay, great. Also, we're the mob, so we murder people.
Yeah,
okay.
They'll say stuff like, "Oh, that guy is from the Greek mafia." Yeah.
It's a part of storytelling is knowing what information is necessary and what information can be withheld. And I feel like they like did the photo negative of that. I wish that when we, because this movie's on Amazon Prime. I wish that when I pressed play, a title card came up that said, "Wait, don't watch this movie until you receive the information packet in the mail." And then I would just get like a special booklet in the mail called "So You're Going to Watch Gotti," and yep. it would explain a lot of the things I needed to know. Yeah. Because
we were watching with the subtitles on, and that didn't really help that much.
Oh, totally.
Now, there's a scene I would want to mention very quickly, my second favorite line in the movie after when he names all of the boroughs, which is John Jr., he's at the military academy. He says a news story about his dad on the mafia being in the mafia because his dad is also famous always, mm-hmm. which was true in real life too. But then it cuts to, for some reason, John Gotti giving his other kids money to see a movie to get them out of the house. And he goes, go see that movie you love about spaghetti, Meatballs. And there's just something so stupid about the specificity of like, look, we got to make sure everyone knows what year it is, so we'll have them go see Meatballs. But I was like, he's Italian, so he's going to think the movie's really about meatballs. Oh, forget about it. Isn't that crazy? Come on. Like, it's such a dumb moment.
He was talking about meatballs. Jesus Christ. I didn't know what movie he was talking about.
So anyway, yeah, he's plotting crimes on the street using terms they wouldn't use. He tells some guys to stop plotting crimes for a moment to help an old lady with her groceries. And he's keeping an eye on local businesses to make sure they're safe and supported. He's just a guy taking care of the neighborhood. Anyway, more and more, John Jr. is getting pulled into the life. John Gotti is meeting lots of other mobsters. There's a scene where he's at a disco and other mobsters are just being pointed out to him. And it feels like it's the recap at the beginning of a mob show. Like they're just like, remember all these guys.
Is he hanging out with Stacey Keach at this point?
Yes. He's hanging out with Stacey Keach, who is what? What's this character's name? Nick or something. I can't remember.
Neil.
But he's the Neil. He's the underboss to Paul Castellano, who's the head of the family. That yeah. they're in. And everyone's like, Stacey Keach, you should be the boss. You shouldn't be the underboss. Stacey Keach seems pretty happy being the underboss. But John Gotti has a problem with the boss, Paul, which is that Paul doesn't care about family. He just cares about money. He's only in the mob for the money. He's not in the mob for all the bullshit, macho loyalty garbage that gets thrown out the window constantly. Because the thing about this movie is it's like,
and whatnot.
It's almost like the Last Samurai of mob movies, where it's like, this is a group of warriors and men of honor who care only about their dignity and about each other. But then everything in the movie is about, no, they're just like violent jerks who beat people up and only want to take stuff. Like that, everyone in the movie is, and John Gotti's like, I'm all about loyalty. Loyalty is the most important thing to me. Now you're going to help me kill my boss or what? And, meanwhile, being a mob boss, it's not all peaches and cream. It's not all champagne and roses, guys. You know what? Being the head of a violent, murderous crime syndicate that likes to pretend it is a sort of quasi-religious fraternal organization built on love, when that love is enforced mainly through violence and money and also the abuse of women and hatred of minorities and all sorts of things. It's not all the dream it sounds like, because Gotti's other son, Frankie, mm-hmm. is hit by a car and killed with all the subtlety of an insurance scare commercial that they show you when you go to an insurance office to get you to buy more insurance. And it almost tears the family apart. And this is a real, you know, it's a real tragedy that could happen to anybody, not just a mob boss. And this is when we see John Gotti really come to the fore as a husband and as a man, because even though he is constantly gone, either in jail or plotting crimes, and his most of his interaction with his sons involves giving them money to go see spaghetti movies, here he is really there emotionally for his wife, who falls apart, and he puts his mob life on hold, you know, for a couple weeks to take his wife on a vacation. And guys, wouldn't we all do the same if our children were killed? Put our jobs on the hold for a couple weeks to take our wives on the vacation so that they can get over it?
I mean, as long as we're men of honor, then yes, of course we would do that, Elliot.
I guess so.
If we're and he's a made man, right? So I'm not super into the mafia stuff. Being a made man is like being a knight, right?
Like yeah, very much so. And similarly, in that being a knight was also gussying up violence and oppression of the weak with this idea of you're doing something holy and better. The mafia is just like that. Yes,
and
only in this case.
Can any made man make another person a made man, like the way a knight can knight someone else?
I don't think so, but I don't think it's like a vampire where you can just bite. A made man bites a made man and turns them into a made man. Although it's one of those things where so they show a made man ceremony later on when John Jr. becomes a made man, and it's basically like they take some blood from your finger and I guess put it on a picture of the Virgin Mary, mm-hmm. and there's a candle there, and they make you swear an oath, and then they tell you that if you ever rat them out, they're going to kill you, and then they're like, now you're our brother, and we're all brothers, because I don't know about you guys, we all have brothers. I don't mm-hmm. usually enforce my relationship with my brother with threats of death if he turns on me.
When we were growing up, there was a lot of that, actually.
I'm not like, my brother is getting married next year, and we've been talking about his bachelor party stuff, and I'm not like, David Kalin, you're my brother. You're always going to be my brother. But if you rat me out, so help me God, I'm going to kill you. I'll kill your family, which is my family. So I'm going to be really sad, but
Elliot,
I'll do it.
Elliot, if you get I have a little idea for your brother's bachelor party.
Okay.
You should get a special guest, Gritty the hockey mascot.
he would love that. That's my brother's the kind of person where I can imagine Gritty shows up at the party and then starts taking the costume off, and there's a stripper underneath, and he's like, no, put the costume back on. I want to hang out with Gritty.
David would be crying because it's like finding out that Santa is just your dad.
Yo. Yeah,
that has been destroyed.
I mean, Art's dad is Santa. He's Tim Allen in the Santa Claus.
Wow.
That's our dad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, when we were a kid, my dad hit Santa with his car and had to take over the role. Uh-huh. And it was hard. It was hard growing up with our dad being so deep in the Santa life, uh-huh. because he often wasn't there. He was with his underbosses, his capos, the elves.
Yeah.
And he would have to plot on his list which kids would get good presents and which kids would get whacked.
Mm.
And, you know, that's the secret about Santa. On the naughty list, those kids, they just disappear them.
Yeah.
But you know, and I wanted to be a maid elf, and I tried so hard, and he took mm-hmm. me aside, and he was like, you're weak. I'm sorry, you're weak. You're never going to have what it takes. And that's why I turned state's evidence and why my dad's in jail.
This is a mashup worthy of a Facebook-promoted T-shirt.
There's got to be some sort of Santa mob. Way that there was that period where where I was constantly seeing people wearing those Looney Tunes like gangsta rap mashup shirts where uh-huh. Bugs and Daffy and Taz will be wearing a ton of rings and gold chains. There's got to be some kind of Santa mafia.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah. I didn't choose the Santa life. The Santa life chose me or something.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
The other thing about that, that
La Cosa Santa, something like that. Yes,
or like, Dan? Or like Mrs. Claus painted up like a Dia de los Muertos lady with a couple like a pair of nickel plated 45s in her hands.
Okay, I mean that's a kind of different criminal organization. That's not the mafia, but
it's still really cool. I mean, that's
pitching awesome.
Ideas.
Yeah.
I thought we were blue skying it right now.
yeah, there are no bad ideas. No bad ideas. Dan, do you have any bad ideas?
No, but I wanted to say that the other thing about that made man ritual or whatever. Like the fact that they did that stuff with the blood and burning the photo, I was just like, I guess this is, you know, like based on this book that you said. So this all has to be accurate. But I had no idea that the mob was so silly.
Yeah, yeah, just like everybody poops. Based on a book, everybody poops.
Yeah, yeah. And like, just like that movie, Two Girls, One Cup, based on the book, everybody poops. Yeah, it's the mob. I mean, here's the thing. One, anything that New York guys from the block do is inherently silly. They're the silliest of all people. And I say that as somebody who grew up in New Jersey, who lived a long time in New York, who really loves those types of people. But they're very silly. But also the mob—that's the thing. It's like the mob is at heart; it's a criminal enterprise. And I know I'm putting my life on the line by saying that, guys. Yeah, so yeah, I need you to protect me. The mob's a criminal enterprise, but they need to pretend it's more than that, or else people will just turn them into the cops all the time, so that they don't go to jail. And so they have to pretend it's a religion, essentially. Now, if I was a real radical, I would say that all religion is in a sense an organized crime that gussies itself up with silly nonsense. But I don't believe that, so I will not say it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's like it's like the cult leader in Mandy. Once his like aura of fear is punctured, his strength, he loses his power.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, once the cult leader in Mandy, he's got to gussy it up, or else he's just a kind of like frail ex-folk singer walking around with an open robe with his penis hanging out. at which point, are you going to go kill Nicolas Cage's wife on his word, on his say-so? I don't think so. Okay, no. Anyway, John Gotti Jr., he keeps falling into the life, but John Gotti lies to his wife and says that John Jr. is going to be kept away from that life. Meanwhile, there's another tragedy, one that the movie treats as almost bigger than the death of a child, when cops wiretap Gotti's best friend, Angelo.
Played by character actor Pruitt Taylor Vince, who's awesome.
Yeah, although he's another one of these characters that showed up in the movie. I'm just like, were you in the movie before?
It was dad's best friend, Ange. Ange was his best friend. I'm like, really? Because they haven't spent any time together until this moment when he needed into the story.
Apparently, early on in the production, this role was supposed to go to Joe Pesci, and then he gained a bunch of weight, and he wasn't able. Then they gave him a different role, and he sued them, and they had to pay him money.
Yeah, this movie.
Wait,
it's like
gave the him wait, hold on, hold on.
The production.
I don't.
The production.
I don't,
wait, back. No, Elliot, shut up for a second. For once in your life, shut up. They gave him a different role because he gained a bunch of weight. Pruitt Taylor Vince is not a small man.
No, he gained for the role, and then they're like, actually, we got Pruitt Taylor Vince, who has not been nominated for Academy Awards like you, Joe Pesci.
I think Joe Pesci won, didn't he?
Yeah, he won.
For Goodfellas?
Yeah.
But the production history of this movie is almost more interesting than the movie. Like, this was going to be like an A-list movie with big-name people in it. And then over time, and this happens to movies all the time, it just kind of like slipped through the cracks and filtered down to this netherworld where it's being directed by a guy from Entourage and MoviePass is one of the big investors.
Yeah.
So
And then John Travolta, we have to say, big star, but he is giving one of the worst performances I've ever seen.
I mean, he's having fun, guys, right?
He's having a good time. It's a thin line because
he's
trying
a lot of this thing.
He is so good in The People versus O.J. Simpson, and that performance is not that different in some ways than this one. But there, I think he's so good at it, but he's playing this very flamboyant, strange man. And here he needs to be playing a guy who can be taken seriously as a cunning mob boss, and instead he's playing it like this weird, flamboyant, strange man. So if it was like, if this was a movie that was called like The Craziest Mob Boss, and he was the mob boss where everyone was like, what's the deal with this guy? He's so weird. And that point, I mean, John Travolta's got a weird energy about him that I like. He's kind of like, but in this one, it doesn't work. Okay, anyway.
And the whole time while watching this movie, I kept expecting Frank D'Angelo to walk in and start singing a song.
It does feel like a Frank D'Angelo movie that Frank D'Angelo turned down. Like, like he's like, I've got standards. No, thank you. You know, I left my heart in San Francisco. Shabubba-da-bubba-da-boom. So the cops wiretapped Angelo, and on the tapes, he says things about bad things about the big boss, Paul, and also he talks about unsanctioned hits and stuff and crimes that Paul didn't sanction. The lesson that I learned from this movie is that mobsters, for all their talk of loyalty and respect and honor, they're constantly pulling off crimes their bosses did not give them permission to do. That seems to be the running thread, and Paul wants those tapes, and Gotti is like, well, we got to kill Paul. I got to save Angelo. Meanwhile, Gotti beats the rap on a RICO case. There's a big street celebration that I think is also the 4th of July, where fireworks are going off in the city streets, and some cops are like, hey, we got to shut this down. But John Gotti stands up to them, and the cops stand down, and the neighborhood cheers, because who's really in charge? John Gotti.
Yeah, the cops realize that the small folk are with Gotti.
Yeah, because once you get the money, then you get the fireworks,
yeah,
and then you get
the
power.
Of the commons.
Yeah. But Gotti just keeps trying to kill Paul, and meanwhile, there's another childhood friend of his who he has killed because he was an informant. But then Stacy Keach dies, and Paul, the big boss, he does the worst thing, doesn't show up the funeral. And okay. John Gotti's like, this is unacceptable. And it is a pretty dick move. Like, it's like if, you know, you didn't show up at the funeral of the person you're closest to because – I don't remember what they said he had to do. I think he was on a boat or something, or he had to, he was making, he had to do a personal appearance on The Price is Right or something. I don't know.
Yeah,
where do you think he was that was more important than his underboss's funeral?
Dan.
Which guy?
Oh, boy. Okay. Moving on.
He had, Saturday Night Live tickets, and those are, he had put so much money into those. So,
well, the thing he really wanted to see the rehearsal. Because show, we all see the show, but the rehearsal, that's where the magic gets made. And sometimes some of the best sketches show up and then get killed. Mm-hmm. But so John Gotti, he still wants to kill Paul, and now he really wants to kill him. And so this is when they pull off the one scene in the movie where I was like, oh, yeah, I remember this stuff, where Paul Castellano is assassinated outside of Sparks Steakhouse in Manhattan. Let me just say this about Sparks Steakhouse.
Okay.
I wish... This is someone who loves steakhouses. I have a personal favorite steakhouse. That's Keen's in Manhattan. Yeah. I wish that Sparks was up to the same level of quality that I feel the band Sparks is at. Uh-huh. Because I don't think it's that great a steakhouse. And if I was a mob boss, I would be kind of disappointed if I was killed in front of Sparks Steakhouse. I'd rather be killed in front of Keen's, Peter Luger's,
yep.
maybe even Wolfgang's.
Yep.
Like,
Old Homestead.
You know what? Old Homestead, the oldest steakhouse in New York. Uh-huh. You know what? At a certain point, I might even pick being killed in front of a Ruth's Chris.
I mean, if we're talking about chain steakhouses, Ruth's Chris is pretty great.
Yeah, or a Morton's. Ruth's Chris and Morton's are fine chain steakhouses. Sparks, not as crazy. So again, I just want to make it clear, if I'm ever a mob boss and you want to kill me in front of a steakhouse, please kill me. Unless it's the fact is like you're killing me in front of a Sparks because you're like, he's going to be disappointed in this steak. I want to not make mm-hmm. him feel that disappointment. I'll kill him before he eats it. Because if I get shot in front of Keen's, I'll be so disappointed that I'm not going to be chowing down on one of those dinosaur-sized yeah. prime ribs underneath a ceiling hung with clay pipes,
yep.
Surrounded by old newspapers from the 19th century.
Yeah, you don't want to eat in a place that's with walls plastered with pictures of Don Shula and other members of the Miami Dolphins franchise.
Well, no, that's why I wouldn't eat in a Shula. if I was going to be assassinated. Although Shula's not the best chain steakhouse. They're okay. They're not terrible. But I remember this being like, this was a big event when it happened. And this was the one time where I was like, oh yeah, here's something I know about John Gotti. Now, of course, this is one of the times, this is maybe the most famous thing he ever did, other than I guess dying in jail. And this is one where they go so overboard with the archival news footage. And here's one thing I liked about this movie is that they show you a lot of archival news footage of John Gotti, like just uh-huh. news stories covering him during the 80s. And it's like, oh, I kind of wish this was a documentary that was just like pieced together from old news stories and didn't have all this other stuff. Did you guys ever feel that way? I mean, I love watching old news stuff. What do you
I certainly
think?
Felt like whenever the news reports were on, like were the only times I understood what was going on in the movie. I'm like, yes, thank God. Like someone's explaining what's happening in this film.
You know, oh, thank the maker, finally.
Yeah. It's like you paused the movie and it had the IMDb trivia pop up on the side. Type thing. Or it listed what actors were playing what roles, and you're like, that's who that is. I dug it. It's with the archival news footage, and it was a little disorienting because they do, except for like one specific thing, they do make no effort to disguise what John Gotti actually looks like and what John Gotti Jr. actually look like. So it's a little weird to see in a movie to see those two things, to see that and then Travolta in his crazy makeup.
I mean, to see how much fatter the real John Gotti Jr. Was a real shock to me.
He isn't like a super buff dude.
He wasn't, and apparently was not 21 years old his whole life. He didn't look like a high school football player his whole life, or a high school swimmer, I guess.
I thought it was a tin drum situation where he decided he would never he would stop aging.
That's the power of the mob. Yep.
Yeah, he's like, I'm never gonna stop aging, and my hair is never gonna change except for getting taller or flatter.
Well, that's the thing, is that let's make him look older. I know, we'll give him a kid and play haircut. That's what'll do it. That'll really age him. But it was a little jarring to see, although it bugs me when they do in movies, sometimes more jarring when they have fake archival footage with the actor in it. But it was jarring to see the real John Gotti, who just in his news footage exudes much more charisma than John Travolta exudes here. Yeah. And then to see the real John Gotti Jr. and then see, like, it did feel a little bit like you suddenly were watching the community theater performance of a famous movie or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, John Gotti gets named the new head of the Gambino crime family. Now he's famous. He's on the news all the time. Lots more mob shenanigans. Gotti's best friend Angelo tries some unsanctioned hits on Gotti's enemies. And to save his life, Gotti exiles him from the family. A year later, he dies, as John Gotti says in voiceover, of a broken heart. Oh, so sad.
Okay, just like Queen Amidala.
Yep.
They're very similar in a lot of ways.
That, right? He's like, he died of a broken heart, just like Queen Amidala.
And then, and there's also a medical bot next to him. So now John Gotti's sitting on top of the world. He's the head of the Gambino crime family. Uh-huh. His son's a made man. He's forgotten that his other son died. His other best friend is gone, so he never has to buy him a birthday present anymore, which is a lot of pressure to figure out the right thing to buy for a friend or a good friend for their birthday party.
Good fella.
Yeah, or a good fella. There's a scene in the movie where they're like, yeah, so-and-so's a good fella, but da-da-da-da. And it's like, wait, you know that they didn't really say good fella, right? Like, the term was wise guy, but there was a TV show called Wise Guy, and that's what they called a good fella. Like, it's a mob movie made by people who know the mob from mob movies. But anyway, John Gotti sits down.
I almost expected him to call him a good feather, because that's about the knowledge of fucking mob movies they have.
That would be so funny if they're all constantly bobbing their heads like pigeons. Trust me, I saw Animaniacs. I know what the mob is like. And then for some reason, John Gotti sings a song with every country in the world in it. So John Gotti sits his son down. He's got a big goal. He wants to build a nationwide mob empire that will last 100 years. And it's one of those moments that's like, okay, hold on a second. Like, maybe that was his ambition, but that's one, crazy. Mm-hmm. Two, it's stupid. Three, he sounds like Hitler when he says it. And four, the movie presents it as if he's a real man of vision and this is an amazing goal that he should be working towards.
Yeah.
Like, when in any movie has anyone ever said, I want to build something that's going to last 100 years, and it hasn't either, one, fallen apart instantly, or two, been evil?
Yeah. Yeah, that's... I mean, when they created the ring of satellites around the Earth to prevent geostorms... It just made geostorms, so I think that was a mistake.
Yeah, we all remember when that happened, yeah. Well, they shouldn't have given the Gambino crime family the contract for building those satellites.
The geosatellites, yeah.
Yeah, because then when they took the geosatellites down, they're just full of guys who had to disappear.
This is kind of...
They just stuffed them full of bodies.
This is kind of tough at this point in the movie. This is where I was getting kind of bored, and I was like, do I have to put enough attention to this movie, or can I just sit here and unlock more characters in Smash Brothers? Because I'm just working on trying to get Wario unlocked, because I kind of see a lot of...
It's pretty hard, right?
Yeah, and I kind of see a lot of myself in Wario, you know?
Because you're both an evil version of someone else?
Yeah, and we're both like, business-minded, you know, and... recognizable laughs.
Stuart, you've mentioned Wario being a small business owner before. What is his business?
His business is beating the shit out of Mario, dude.
Wait.
So do people hire him to do that?
And it's booming.
Has money changed at some point?
But guys, I think you're both going to be happy to know that I, like Wario, had the professionalism to not do that and focus on the movie.
Yes, good. Because you know who are the original Smash Brothers? the mafia.
Oh,
so
no
moving
kidding.
Along, John Jr. gets married, and he has his first dance to a song about a dad giving advice to his son, because even John Gotti Jr.'s wedding has to be about John Gotti, which is crazy. It's the least romantic song anyone has ever danced to.
Charlene was so mad there was no Frank Sinatra song.
I mean, they're not going to pay for the rights for that, but they should have done the thing that Dan and Maya's friend Eric Marcizak once told me about a wedding he went to where the DJ said, "Hold on, look who's here. It's Old Blue Eyes." And then kind of a mascot version of Frank Sinatra with a huge Frank Sinatra head walked out and was miming singing into a microphone as a Frank Sinatra song played. And it was the funniest thing I've ever heard, I think.
That would be incredible. I went to a Sweet 16 that was the most Bensonhurst Italian thing you could go to. And at one point, the DJ said out loud, "Is anybody here Italian?" And everybody lost their mind. And then the tarantella started, and I had to get the fuck out of the way, or else I'd be crushed.
In the rush to the dance floor.
It was awesome.
Now, you were almost, and if, when you died, your autopsy report would have said cause of death, hospitaliano. So now John Gotti, but he's on trial for the murder of Paul, and Sammy the Bull Gravano, that murderous rat, testifies against him in exchange for life in the witness protection program. The movie does not mention that Sammy the Bull eventually went to jail anyway for drug dealing. Not the great guy that we were led to believe, this man, Sammy the Bull, who was a hitman.
But he also, and they made a point when that character was first introduced, that John Gotti didn't trust him. Like,
yes,
it's like he had his Gotti sense was tingling. Even though his boy Chris Mulkey was backing him up, character actor Chris Mulkey.
Yeah, there was absolutely no reason at that point in the movie for John Gotti to suspect him.
He didn't,
except for the fact that later on we have to know that he's going to be a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's called brilliant foreshadowing.
Yeah.
There's some unsanctioned killings as a result. John Jr. puts his foot down, no more killings. Mrs. Gotti is very upset that her son's a gangster. You said you'd keep him away from that life and so forth. But then, so John Gotti goes to jail because he did it. He committed that crime. Uh-huh. Gotti got it. He got a sentence in jail. And John Jr. gets arrested. And he wants to, and this is that great scene where he says goodbye to his kids who all look older than him somehow. And he wants to sign this plea deal so that he can be in jail and then get out in time for his kids to be his age. And Gotti Sr. says, "No, if I was you, I wouldn't do that. I want to go into that courtroom one last time and stand up to everyone." And he says, "and break their holes," which is a crazy way to describe it. And it's like, it was such a gross way for someone to talk about, like, being a man and standing up for himself. To be like, "I'm going to go in there and break their holes." Because it's like, it's so disgusting. And they
you're not gonna steal that line for when you have the talk with your son.
Now, Elliot,
I don't know. I'm not sure which talk that would be.
Now, Elliot, which holes are they talking about? I don't understand.
Now let's take a moment and talk about that, because the human body only has so many holes. There's your nostrils, your ear holes, your mouth hole,
your pizza pie hole.
Pizza pile. There's the holes in your eyes that let light in. There's your pores. Maybe he's talking about their pores, like covering them in gold paint like the woman in Goldfinger. And they asphyxiate because of the pores. And then there's the other holes. There's for the front hole for urination and the back hole for defecation. And now those holes, there's multiple uses for them. Sometimes you're putting things in for pleasure. Sometimes you're taking babies out of them. But but it takes a lot to break them. Like, people put their holes through a lot of punishment for pleasure, and they rarely break, and they're often fixable.
Now, Elliot,
and
so is this what the movie Holes is about, what you're telling me right now?
Not having seen it, I'll have to assume that yes.
I mean,
the movie Holes is about
based on the expression
Shia LaBeouf.
That Shia LaBeouf has on the box art, I think, yeah, it's about that.
Now, I don't know if it's about a boy whose holes are broken and has to get them fixed, or a boy who's under threat of having his holes broken. But it's like, at a certain point, you have to wonder what's going to say break about an organic part of the body that's not a bone is weird. Like, those holes are soft tissue. So to say break is like, if it's gross to say tear their holes, but that's more accurate. And there's often some tearing, say, during natural childbirth, during vaginal childbirth. And that's a natural thing that happens because babies are huge and they're coming out of a very small space. Now, to say break implies that there's a hard structure to it, that there might be cracks or some kind of fracturing where maybe pieces flake off or fall off, like it pebblizes a little bit.
Yeah.
So I don't know what he's – is he talking about – first that he's going to freeze them with liquid nitrogen
yes.
and then smash them with a sledgehammer.
Because yep. Specifically their whole area.
Just the whole area. So he needs to use one of those little doctor hammers that you use to test your reflexes so mm-hmm. he doesn't break the whole body. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's a localized use of the nitrogen yep. to just freeze that part. But it's a very good question. What holes is he talking about, and how is he going to break them? And it's the subject of today's episode of the flop holes.
Now, it's the ear holes.
Now, here on the flop holes, we talk about holes and things that people do with them. And today we're talking about breaking holes. That's right. Break into electric hole-a-loo. And my guests today are Dan McCoy, hole specialist. Dan McCoy is and Stuart yes, Wellington, okay. who often shops at Whole Foods. Your place for food that goes in your holes. Now, guys, when I say break your holes, what does that conjure up in your minds? I just want to get your first impressions.
Why did Dan look at me?
Well, I mean, I feel like we've already kind of covered what I get in my head. I get like a guy with a big sledgehammer kind of just like cracking it into someone's butt.
Okay. And now the butt already has a crack in it.
Yeah.
This is creating new cracks or different cracks? How does this work exactly? Be very extreme in your detailing.
It's more about shattering the pelvis, I think.
Okay. Now you're talking about that. Okay. So Stuart, now, your experience with holes is a little different. Uh-huh. Whole Foods is a chain of grocery stores owned by the Amazon company, which also distributed Gotti, the film we were talking about earlier.
Yeah,
now, if he was saying break Whole Foods, would that mean like what, to literally demolish a storefront? Or is he talking about driving the company into bankruptcy, which will be hard to do since Amazon has such deep pockets? What do you think, Stuart?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a tough one. I think putting a second crack on a butt is kind of like a madman's gambit. I think people haven't considered horizontal as a possibility.
So more of a whole reorientation than a breaking.
I'm going to get out some graph paper here in a minute, and I think, I mean, I don't know about the angles. There could be an issue. Maybe if I fold the graph paper, it might work that way. We'll find out.
Great. Now, while we give Stuart some time, let's go to our next segment, the Flop Hole Recommends, where we recommend movies or books related to holes. Uh-huh. Now, of course, I'm going to recommend Disney's The Black Hole, the story of a spaceship that literally goes into a person's butt and finds a portal to hell.
Wait, is that what happens in that movie?
There's also a lovable robot and also kind of a mean robot, and I guess they all fit into somebody's butt. Now, my runner-up recommendation is, of course, the movie Holes, starring Shia LaBeouf, which I haven't seen, but I have to assume is about a boy who's either has a broken hole that he needs to fix yep. or is in danger of having his hole broken. Do you guys have any recommendations for the recommendation segment
sure.
of the Flop Hole?
I'll recommend Ace in the Hole, uh-huh. starring Kirk Douglas, originally called The Big Carnival. It's a, you know, it's
which
a very
would be
cynical,
inappropriate for this segment if it was named that.
Cynical examination of how the media can drum up a story.
Now, it's about someone who gets trapped in a collapsed mine, which is literally a broken hole in the earth, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm going to recommend The Whole 9 Yards, which I think is better than its sequel, The Whole 10 Yards, which, I mean, though still appropriate for this segment, didn't come to mind first.
And now it's time to turn to our sponsor. We're sponsored tonight by Holebuster, which is both a video store that only has movies about holes and also a place to go to get your hole busted. Which hole do you want? How much you want it busted? That's up to you. Holebuster.
Oh, now, wow. What, a scale 1 to 10? What's going on there? Yeah. Or do they have different like face images to represent the amount of busted?
No, I can't say I've never been there, but you know, I'll just say Holebuster. Go there. You get 10% off with the code FLOP. Holebuster, bustin' makes you feel good. Now, turning back to Gotti, John Jr., he signs the plea agreement. John Gotti, he doesn't want to leave jail. He fights his cancer in jail. He refuses a pain-killing coma. And also, when a priest comes to administer last rites, he waves the priest away as if to say, no, I like being a mobster more than I like the grace of God and more than I like going to heaven. I'd rather go to hell a mob boss than go to heaven kneeling at the feet of that whole God. Mm-hmm. And so, okay. Now, here's another sponsor for the Flop Hole, the Whole Earth Catalog. Now, The Earth has a hole in it that leads to Pellucidar, a hidden land of dinosaurs. You might want to order something from there, the whole Earth catalog. Now John Gotti dies, and it's all over the news. And again, this is when I learned that John Gotti was actually younger when he died than John Travolta is now. And yet they caked John Travolta with enough makeup he looks like Little Big Man in the at the end of his life. And we see period footage of John Gotti's funeral and a lot of local mooks talking about how John Gotti was so great and he kept the neighborhood safe.
This was the point at which I was like, he's dead. Why isn't the movie over?
Nope. It just keeps going.
But people love – like, people at the time walked – like, they – I mean, they showed archival news footage. Like, there were riots when Gotti was put in jail. People were walking around wearing free John Gotti shirts. I wish it was Gandhi. That would have been better.
Or John Gandhi, who was a mob boss who believed in nonviolent crime.
I think you're only allowed one crazy digression per 20 minutes, Elliot, so you can't.
All right,
John
fair
Gandhi
point.
Segment.
My parole officer is shaking his head. He agrees with you. Yeah. So John Junior's still on – he goes on trial even though he signed a plea deal. They never really explain what happened there, but I guess it's that the government is like going after him with case after case and charge after charge to oppress him because the government just hates Gotti's. You look at the oppressed cases in American history and you've got, of course, slaves, Native Americans, different types of worker, and of course the Gottis among the most oppressed by the government. And John Gotti and Mrs. Gotti puts on this. She finally has her big scene where she yells in the court about how this is crazy. Stop harassing him. But
we've seen him do crimes, guys.
Yeah,
yeah.
He's done a bunch of crimes. It's not like
we
he's
saw him
not
as the
a criminal.
He is a criminal, but he gets acquitted. And there's some end text stating that the government kept going after the Gottis, and they released hundreds of killers to get their testimony to put John Gotti Jr. and John Gotti in jail. And the implication is that the government so hated these two guys that they unleashed a wave of monsters in exchange to try to capture them. That it was literally a case of, we got to catch these two rats, so I guess we'll have king cobras all over America in every bed biting our children. And then we cut to John Gotti again in front of that bridge, and he goes, if you live to be 5,000, you'll never see another guy like me. And it's like, dude, I've seen so many guys like you in the movies, in the White House, in the state I grew up in. Like, the movie really fails to get across what was special about John Gotti. So, guys, what do you think was special about John Gotti that they decided to make this movie about him?
His hair?
I mean, he's larger-than-life. He was a larger-than-life, like, actual organized crime figure who captured the public imagination. He was on like major news publications covers. Like, he was on,
that's true.
That's why they made a movie out of him.
That's true. He was the Bachelor for one season too.
it's kind of weird though, cause I'm assuming his family had a lot of input in the making of this movie. It actually kind of reminded me of another biopic that Dan and I watched recently, Bohemian Rhapsody, which was clearly like deeply influenced by the surviving members of Queen. So it like blanded out all the possible drama and painted all those characters in a very specific light. And it's very much an advertisement for, and this, like, that was an advertisement for the music of Queen. This is, I guess, an advertisement for, I don't know, the Mafia.
I guess so. Yeah.
And they're both movies like built around one specific performance. You know, John Travolta in that old age makeup wearing John Gotti's clothes, Rami Malek in his makeup wearing Freddie Mercury's mustache.
And teeth.
Yeah.
Giant fake horse teeth.
Yeah.
Wait, so did they dig up Freddie Mercury and take off his mustache and his teeth so that Rami Malek could use them in the part?
No, he had to break into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and get them.
Yeah, it was a,
that's
it was
right,
a heist.
I forgot. Now there's a movie, Rock and Roll Heist.
I mean, isn't that like the Pick of Destiny, the Tenacious D movie?
Don't I guess it is.
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I think maybe you're right.
I guess this is the point at which we do final judgments usually.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I mean, this movie, it leaves me so exhausted.
Why break the chain?
Yeah.
Good, bad movie or bad movie or a movie you kind of like?
The question, will the circle be unbroken, is asked, and Dan says, no, it will not be. We will do final judgments. So I'm gonna go first. I'm gonna say it had so much potential to be a good bad movie because there's so much wacky stuff in it, but it just pounds you down. I would say the first half of this movie is like good bad, and by the second half you're just like, I don't know. It's just scenes being thrown at you, and there's no – it's hard to understand what's going on, and it really gets to the point – like, it just takes it so much for granted that the audience is on John Gotti's side from the beginning, that he doesn't have to win you over. He's such a lovable character, and it's – you know, the one thing they're missing is, I guess, like, the Pope canonizing John Gotti at the end, mm-hmm. but – it's I would say bad. It lived up to the hype of being a really bad movie, but it didn't live up to the hype of being the most fun bad movie of the year. Guys, what do you think?
Was it supposed to be the most fun bad movie of the year? Was that the word about it?
I don't know.
Because I think it's bad. I think that the John Travolta's performance is comically over the top. Mm-hmm. I think that there's so many funny things. Like, they're like these crazy needle drops all the time in the movie. There's so many like music cues.
they have all these pop songs that don't really relate to what's going on camera.
Yeah, and just, I mean, the lines, like you say, are so stupid from time to time. But the fact that I just couldn't follow a goddamn thing means that I just can't recommend it at all for like a bad movie.
Yeah, that it manages to at the same time give too much and too little information.
Yeah, you, by the end of it, you're like you're struggling under all the facts they've given you, and yet you have no idea what any of them mean.
Yeah, no, I actually think you have the right of it, Elliot. I think it the beginning feels like a good bad movie, and then like as I said, like. It makes you long to go and grind out some more characters on Super Smash Brothers Ultimate.
I would say watch it until Angelo dies, until they exile Angelo, because there's the funny part where he exiles Angelo and then Angelo leaves the kind of dank social club that all the mobsters hang out at, and they just all look away from him as if they can't see him. And it's very funny that the ultimate mob punishment, the cold shoulder.
Yeah, yeah. He walks out and they react like John Cena's waving his hand in front of his face.
Hey, Max Fun listeners. Have you been listening to Max Fun for a while and you've just been wondering, where's the new Flat Earth podcast I keep hearing about?
Well, here it is. We give you all the facts on NASA's lies and how we know that the Earth is actually flat.
Just kidding.
This is Ono, Ross, and Carrie, and we join fringe religious groups. We undergo alternative medical treatments.
And we hang out with people like 9/11 truthers, flat earthers. We find out, why do people believe strange things?
We join them, and we tell you all about it. We have a lot of fun. We make a lot of friends.
Yeah, we do. We joined the Mormons. We joined the Scientologists. We got acupunctured. We got fire cupped. We got ear candled. We've done it all, and we're going to keep doing it all. Why don't you check out Ono, Ross, and Carrie at MaximumFun.org?
Hi, this is Rachel McElroy.
Hello, this is Griffin McElroy.
And this is Wonderful.
It's a podcast that we do as we are married. And how's the ad going so far? Because I think it's going very good.
We talk about things we like every week on Wednesdays.
One time Rachel talked about pumpernickel bread. It was so tight. You cannot afford to miss her talking about this sweet brown bread.
We also talk about music and poems and, you know, weather.
There was one... weather? One time Rachel talked about Baby Beluga, this song, for like 14 minutes. And it just really blew my hair back.
So check us out on MaximumFun.org.
It's a cool podcast with chill vibes. Amber is the color of our energy, is what all the iTunes reviews say.
They will now.
There's no sponsors this week, but we do have a Jumbotron that I would like to read.
Uh-huh.
And it goes a little something like this. This is a... This message is for Dad.
Do you want us to leave the room? Because I know these solo Dan reads are the
very popular.
Yeah.
People love them.
Okay, sorry for interrupting.
I mean, this is a Jumbotron, so I don't think it works that
okay,
way.
Okay, cool.
You're not going to take as much liberty with the text.
Yeah.
Not going to spend as much time being a self-deprecating, lovable teddy bear in this one.
This one's for Dad, which is very non-specific.
For one person, it's very specific.
Yeah.
I like how Dan was like, I'm not going to do this the way I do a solo ad read, and then immediately started going after the subject of this, what I assume is going to be a heartfelt Jumbotron if it's too Dad.
I want to make sure it gets to the right person, and I don't know if Dad's the most clear, but
I assume that from the context of it, it's the same way that when my family gives me a Father's Day card, it just says to dad. It doesn't say like to Elliot Kalen, the dad of these children, with our fingerprints and the birth certificate stapled to it.
Yeah. First of his name.
This is
they don't print out my ancestry.com tree and my 23andMe results to make sure it goes to the right dad.
And your twinning celebrity lookalike percentage. Oh, Eddie Deason.
Excuse me, I would be honored to be Eddie Deason's twin.
So this one's for
the
dad.
The man's a national treasure and a Beatles expert.
This is from Parker. That narrows it down.
Yeah, sure.
And Parker says, Dad, first of all, thank you for buying me Elliot's book. I can't wait to read it with you. In my first 6 months here on Earth, you've exposed me to a lifetime of podcast content, but I can tell that Stuart, Dan, and Elliot make you LOL the most. Since I'm a baby, I don't get why it's funny. Neither does Mom. But it makes me happy to see you. So that's interesting.
Well, I applaud Dan for not reading that in Dan's affected baby voice that he does sometimes.
As his character, Baby Boy Dan McCoy, his SNL audition piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where he's like, quick, I got to get into makeup, and then smears jam all over his lips.
What?
Yeah. That's what babies look like.
They've got jam all over their lips?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that was the whole message, Dan?
Yeah, that's it.
That's a very sweet message. That's adorable. How nice. And I'm impressed that this baby could handle the Max Fun Jumbotron interface, not because it's difficult, because the baby is so young.
Mm-hmm. I think we have a genius on our hands.
Yeah, we've got some live shows to promote, right?
Let's do it. We got two live shows to promote. You've heard us talking about how on January 26th we'll be at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in beautiful Madison, Wisconsin. Saturday, January 26th at the Wisconsin Union Theater, Shannon Hall, I believe, is the location, we'll be talking about Venom. That's right. My favorite Marvel character, circa age 13, got his own movie. I still haven't seen it yet. We're going to talk about it.
I think Venom is kind of like the John Gotti of Marvel heroes.
In that he's a lethal protector, I guess so, maybe.
And because John Gotti was covered in a symbiote from outer space.
Yeah, John Gotti had that huge tongue that people on the internet find sexy for some reason.
I can explain the reason if you want me to. John Gotti is very similar to Venom in that Eric Larson also did not like drawing John Gotti and decided to make him as monstrous and crazy as possible.
Oh.
Hence the long tongue and the teeth. Okay, it would take a young Mark Bagley to reassert that Venom is not just a slobbery monster drool creature. Okay, now, we have a new show to advertise. Guys, can we talk about it? Dan, can we say it?
I'll allow it. There's nothing in the rule book that says he can't promote it.
Okay, that's right, boys. We're going back to our old stomping grounds of the Bell House, Brooklyn, New York. Bell House. Sunday, February 3rd. That's right, Super Bowl Sunday. We'll be talking about, or can we say the movie or no?
Let's say the movie.
Yeah, so we'll be talking about, I think, what, the Happy Time Murders?
That's what we decided on.
Yeah, it should be fun.
Football themed show, Super Bowl Sunday. Hey, do you guys hate football like I do? Come to the one guaranteed show my brother won't be at. Sunday, February 3rd at the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York.
I mean, just based on law of averages, even if you like football, it's most likely that your team isn't in the big game. So why don't you come watch us instead?
That's true. And guys, I'm going to have a little extra pep in my step because it's going to be the day after I celebrate my grandmother's 90th birthday party. So watch out, I might be a little hungover. Mm-hmm. But that's okay. Super Bowl Sunday, February 3rd in Brooklyn and January 26th in Wisconsin. Yeah. Get your tickets to those ones. The Bell House ones, the tickets might not be available yet, but hopefully they will be soon.
Yeah. And do you really want to just go along with a fucking crowd? Do you like football that much?
Whoa.
No, you don't. You're just going to watch the Super Bowl because that's what everyone in the U.S. is doing. But why?
Wow. Okay. One, it's an American tradition. Everybody loves it. Two, there's always the chance that it'll be like my favorite Super Bowl, that year when the lights went out in half the stadium and they had to stop the play, but they kept broadcasting it. And it was just confused football people wandering around in the dark, wondering what was going to happen next.
Mm-hmm.
That was my favorite football game of all time. It was so real.
Can we announce the, I don't know why I'm asking. Dan will edit this out if I'm wrong. And Dan and I are going to be guests at another show at the Bell House on Saturday, January 12th. We're going to be guests on a live Ono Ross and Carrie show.
Cool.
Hopefully we're going to get electrodes attached to some part of our bodies.
Mm-hmm. One of your holes is going to get broken. Yeah. Which one?
I don't think.
Yeah, you got to show up. The bell has to find out.
Yeah, they haven't told us exactly what crazy experiment we have to take part in yet, so...
Yeah, I mean, I hope they don't tell me until I literally walk out in front of a room full of people, and then I go, ghosts, and then ghosts come and tear my body apart.
that's what you hope for?
Right? Yeah.
So that's your best case scenario.
That's my best case scenario.
Okay, interesting. So we got those live shows. Guys, let's move on to the next segment, which is letters.
Uh-huh.
All right. Thanks for telling me.
Oh, wow. Thanks for keeping your foot on the gas here, Elliot.
Yep.
Let me pull up the letters.
While Dan's doing that, hey, Elliot, what's going on with you, buddy? You watch any new TV? You see that Romanoffs?
It didn't take that long. I had it right here.
I saw a little bit of Romanoffs. I've been watching that Haunting of Hill House show.
Oh, is it too spooky?
It's very spooky. And you know what the spookiest thing about it is? Uh-huh. Carla Gugino just does not seem to age. It's amazing. Yeah. Is she a ghost? Yeah. I don't understand it.
Yeah, is she planning to play John Gotti Jr. in an upcoming biopic?
I don't know. Maybe. That's a weird leap. She's playing Joan Gotti in the gender-swapped version of Gotti.
Or Joan Gotti Jr. in this case, since that actor didn't age. Dan, let's power forward.
Okay. Football.
It's basketball.
Oh, is it? I was trying to relate it back to the Super Bowl.
And you did a great job. You did a great job.
Thanks. this letter is from someone that I don't have the name. So I apologize that I do not have your name. I hope that you will still enjoy hearing your letter read on the air.
As always, 5-star community outreach and customer service, courtesy of the Flophouse.
Yep. This letter's from Anonymous, make sure that you're wearing some kind of cool V for Vendetta mask.
Or writing the novel Primary Colors, a Romana Clef about the Clinton campaign. Mm-hmm. Now, the Flophouse really knows how to make its listeners feel special.
Okay. Moving on to the letter from Anonymous. Yeah. My wife and I recently watched Hitchcock's 1937 film Young and Innocent, a crime thriller in which the daughter of the local chief constable risks it all to prove the innocence of a man she's only just met. We were really enjoying the performances and the cinematography, and the effects were impressive. At the end, though, things got a bit weird. The climax of the film...
Are they going to talk about the blackface stuff at the end?
Elliot, don't fucking spoil the letter.
Okay, sorry.
The climax.
Hey, I don't know. Hey, if I knew who wrote it, I'd be worried about offending them. But it's just an anonymous letter that a bird dropped in your lap. Thinking that your head was a rock that it could break open the letter on and eat its sweetmeats inside. It just dropped it on you.
The climax of the film takes place in a hotel restaurant with a crowded dance floor and live band. The heroine and her companion are searching for the man they believe to be the killer, who they know has a twitchy eye. We're treated to some dramatic irony as the camera makes a very slow push in across the dance floor to the band, to a close-up of the eyes of the band's drummer, which we see to be twitching. This is all very tense stuff and great filmmaking, or at least it would be, if not for the fact that halfway through the push-in, my wife and I realized the entire band, other than the white singer, was white guys in blackface. Holy shit, we both exclaimed.
Mm-hmm.
And basically lost it.
They said, holy shit, we explained. Some shit is holy if it comes out of a saint, maybe, or the Dalai Lama.
We finished the movie.
It'll be stuck in a reliquary and then sold off by a traveling, gewgaws salesman.
Yeah, and when the new Dalai Lama is born, they hold out poop from 3 different people, one of them the old Dalai Lama, and then 2 random strangers. And the child must reach out to the poop that belonged to him in a previous life.
Mm-hmm.
Continue with the letter.
We finished the movie after a bit, but it kind of spoiled the mood. Has something like this ever happened to you? Can you think of a time when an older movie seemed timeless right up until it really, really wasn't? Keep on flopping in the free world, ROCK in the USA.
Now, I'm going to say, one, this happens in a ton of old movies, but that part doesn't really bother me, and I'll tell you why. One, the audience of the movie is not supposed to be enjoying that these people are in blackface. To me, it is... It is a moment in entertainment history from England in the 30s when blackface was common. But you, the viewer, are not supposed to be like, I love it. This is great. This is the villain of the movie is in disguise as a performer in blackface. And so I don't feel like the movie is saying this is a fun thing that everyone's going to enjoy, as opposed to, say, A Day at the Races, which is an okay Marx Brothers movie. It's not one of their best, but it's okay until the big number where they're dancing and singing with the village full of black people that suddenly appeared out of nowhere behind, and they're all talking in dialect, and the Marx Brothers, for a brief moment, try to hide by putting grease on their faces so that they are in blackface, and it's like, that's supposed to be a funny moment. It's supposed to be something that the audience is amused by, and that doesn't work for me. But something like the scene in Young and Innocent, I don't think the audience of the movie is supposed to be like, this is hilarious that they're in blackface. I think it's more of a – it's a detail that's meant to help disguise the identity of the real criminal that much more. What do you guys think?
I mean, it's still – I mean, you still have a reaction to it as in a modern viewer, though.
I guess so, but it doesn't ruin the movie. The movie doesn't feel tainted to me in the way that other movies do for that. There's a – I forget which Fred Astaire movie it is. There's one where he does a dance in blackface as a tribute to Bill Bojangles Robinson.
Uh-huh.
And it's a really beautiful dance, but it's very hard to get through the fact that he's doing it in blackface. But even there, he's doing it not from a point of view of this is hilarious or like I'm doing an exaggerated cartoon version of a black man. That one's more complicated and complex to me, but – it's like, there's so many times in old movies where you have to be like, okay, I don't like this, but that's either from the time, but there are other times when you're like, this is not okay at all still, and it shouldn't have been then, but I don't know. It's so complicated, guys.
Yeah. The other day, the other night I was at the bar, and after RuPaul's Drag Race finished up, I was about to turn the TV off, and then VH1 started playing Pretty Woman, so I'm like, I'm leaving the TV on. And then as Pretty Woman was wrapping up,
but then
like,
big mistake, huge.
And then I was going to turn the TV off again, and it was Dirty Dancing, and I'm like, oh, I'm definitely leaving the TV on. And then I was about to turn off the TV again at like 2 in the morning, and then 16 Candles came on. And 16 Candles is a movie that like, I had on tape as a kid, and I watched so many times, and I haven't seen it in years, and I know it's terrible. Like, I know that, like, there's so much gross shit, and the Long Duck Dong character is so horrible. Like, it's terrible, but I don't know. I watched the opening credits. I'm like, I still like the opening credits. And then the rest of the movie, I had to turn off because it's horrible.
I mean, you hit my go-to, Elliot, with Day at the Races. So
Day at the Races.
Yeah.
There's a lot of movies like that that I really like, but then they mishandle ethnic characters. I mean, like I've mentioned once in a live show that like I love Westerns, but every Western I watch, I have to deal with the fact that it is about the elimination and demonization, usually of an entire type of person, unless it's one of those Westerns they made in the 60s where they're like, well, we'll tell things from the native point of view, but we'll still kind of say it was a good thing that we settled the West. But I was watching Music Man with my son recently. As he called it, it was a four-day movie because we're not going to let him watch a movie that long all at once, so it took him 4 days to watch it. And I love that movie, but there's a scene in it where they have the song Shapoopy,
yeah,
which is maybe my least favorite song in the whole movie, partly because I don't like the term Shapoopy. I don't understand it, and it doesn't sound good to me. My son loves it because it's now he has a sanctioned way to say the word poopy, is if he says Shapoopy. But the whole song is about going after a girl who's hard to get because she'll relent eventually. And there's one verse in it where it's like, give her a squeeze, give her a pinch when she is, and looking, get a pinch back, and that's fancy cooking. And it's like, I don't approve. I don't approve of just going around pinching girls when they're not looking. So that's one of those moments where I was like, but my son was so distracted by the word Shapoopy that he didn't care what the actual song was about. Yeah. So that was fine.
Yeah. Moving.
Hit us with another letter, Dan. Maybe one with a name attached.
Yeah, sure. Okay. This one is from Shane.
The movie. Wait, Shane?
Hold on. No, wait. This one's from Landon.
Okay.
Keeping up my
trend.
Let me
explain. Do I need to explain how letters work to you?
I like the idea that I somehow mistook the word Landon for Shane. Two most different names. No, this is from Landon, last name withheld, who writes, I absolutely love slapstick and physical comedy, a la Chaplin, Keaton, Cary Grant, straight through to Steve Martin, John Ritter, and Melissa McCarthy. However, I find these types of movies, lesser quality ones anyway, are often plagued with unbearable caricatures, character tropes, archetypes, stereotypes, and just downright unfunny characters that immediately make me furious. For instance, any low-rent version of a Jerry Lewis character, or the entirety of the 1967 version of Casino Royale. Are there any types of characters that drive you batty? Love always, Landon, last name withheld. There's one, like, we're not just talking about comedic characters, I don't think. I think it's open to everything, but there's one that really bothers me, and that's the overbearing mother archetype. Like, I just don't find that funny at all. There's
but,
so many...
but Dan, your favorite movie is Where's Papa?
I just like gorillas.
I mean, it's not a real gorilla.
Well, doesn't matter.
you can pretend it is all you want.
No, I just find that, like, I just find it upsetting. I find the overbearing mother character upsetting and unpleasant, and I don't find anything funny about the way that these characters often seem devoted to ruining their children's lives. Like, pardon me. I just find it very bothersome. And of course, any, I don't like sort of like the sassy black character, because I find it very, like, uncomfortably, like, racially tinged. Like, that.
You prefer black characters to know their place and not talk back.
No, that's not it. I just, like, in an all-white movie, when they, like, turn to, like, the black character to just, like, say something snappy and, like,
well, I think that would probably apply also to the one gay character in an otherwise straight movie.
Yeah.
I'm guessing too, right? Where it's like, your job is to be the jester. Yeah. Your job is to do the comments that make everybody laugh. And uh-huh. You have no interior life, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, but
and yet you love the mannequin movies.
I just like the Starship song.
He likes magical necklaces.
Yeah.
What about rapping grannies? Do you like rapping grannies? Or when a stuffy person says something in slang?
Ugh, that's now you're hitting on my favorite comedy trope.
I mean, I
didn't expect them to sound like that.
I mean, we've talked about it a million times, but I think we're all quite sick of the like the nagging girlfriend or bitchy ex-wife character. All the characters that Judy Greer seems to be forced to play.
Unfortunately, she's so much better than that. And I'm going to go with this is a character type that I guess starts with Bill Murray. But has become kind of, in a different way, Chris Pratt's big thing, where it's like the hero who's kind of a jerk to everybody,
mm-hmm.
but it's supposed to be charismatic and is really incompetent and really foolish, and yet he's the hero that everyone's supposed to love, and another character is always pulling their bacon out of the fire, but the other character is not the hero of the movie. Instead, the guy who's a jerk who can't get his act together is the hero.
And, you know, of course, a character trope that I will never get sick of is the medical examiner or coroner who is always eating a sandwich on the job. Hollywood, if you ever need somebody to play that character, I would love to do it. Thank you very much.
I mean, that's lovable. But the thing that it really points out is the lack of workplace labor regulations for coroners. They don't get mm-hmm. a lunch break. They got to work straight through the day.
Oh, wow. And they're like video game developers.
Yeah, exactly. They're working 80, 90-hour weeks so that Electronic Arts can get that game out on time or that autopsy. And it's just not fair to them.
Yeah. I keep putting the phone down in between these letters, and I shouldn't, because I should just keep it open.
Yeah, can we talk? Do we have another letter that's going to bring up negative stuff?
Yeah, do we have another letter that has to involve us grandstanding about things that we feel better than?
No, we've got a fun letter to end on. It's from Shane, last name withheld, the aforementioned Shane.
Mm-hmm.
oh, yeah, I've been looking forward to his letter.
Hey, hi, guys.
Hey, Shane.
You all mentioned Piranha 3D.
Yep.
I was in that when I was 16. Uncredited background, not even an extra, just sort of wandered onto the set.
Cool.
Some trivia about the shooting location. There was a huge die-off of carp that summer, due to a carp-specific herpes going around in the water, and everything in the whole area smelled like dead fish rotting. The boat in one of the caverns is still intact and sitting on my old boss's property. I tried to get into the movie as a stunt performer by waiting outside the director's office and doing flips when he would come out for a cigarette. That didn't work.
I like that moxie, though.
Years later, I ran into the director at an Irish bar in Tempe, Arizona. He gave me his card, and I lost it. I'm also friends with someone high up in the...
Is that Irish bar in Tempe, Arizona that... Oh, fuck. What's that author? There's this, like, author who writes these fantasy books about a fucking druid who lives in Tempe, Arizona. And he's always hanging out at one bar that actually exists, and it's the weirdest fucking thing. Okay, go, Dan.
I don't know why you raised a question that could not be answered.
Somebody will write in.
Yeah. Stuart was sure you or I would know about someone who writes a book about druids in Tempe, Arizona. But here's the cautionary tale of this letter, and knowing it hasn't finished yet, is when someone gives you a business card you want to hold on to, don't do any flips until you've put it on your nightstand.
That's a good point.
Or maybe in your files. Because I have to assume he did a flip in celebration and it fell out of his pocket.
Yeah.
Or because Bazooka Joe did something hilarious.
Yeah, and he just flew backwards with the contents of his pocket spilling out everywhere.
He finishes the letter. I'm also friends with someone high up in the local water department who said it might not even have been herpes that killed those fish. But I forget what his findings indicated it was.
Guys, sounds like we got another mystery on our hands. Book us some flights to wherever they shot that.
I think we got a lot of leads here. We got more information yeah. about this book series Stuart talked about.
We got this herpes thing that I feel was
some like false lead that David Koechner created. So his murder spree was not pinned on him.
We've clearly got to start at this Irish bar in Tempe, Arizona, and then eventually get back there. We've got our team. Now, I'm the stealth guy because I'm short and I'm small, so I can hide in the shadows. Stuart, you're obviously the muscle and also the face. Dan, you're a herpes expert for obvious reasons. We're going to have to solve the problem. What's killing carp in this unnamed lake?
Dan's our tech guy, right? Because he's good at handling the emails and such.
Now, Elliot, weren't you trying to sell this pilot, Fish Herpes Detective?
Yeah, it was called Fish Herpes Detectives. It starred us, but we also had like a cute kid that we had to adopt and went with us. And the kid had a funny lisp, so it would be like, herpes? And we'd have to try to hide what herpes was because they're not ready for that knowledge. Now, here was the problem that a lot of the networks had with it. Mm-hmm. One, the word herpes in the title, but I stood firm on that. That wasn't going anywhere. Two, the budget I was asking for of $20 million an episode just for the three of us, not counting production costs. The rest would be kind of on a shoestring. And three, that we were going to investigate one specific fish herpes mystery but never solve it. The way Twin Peaks was supposed to be done. Uh-huh. And also, I was going to try to get the log lady back out of retirement so that she could be a main character on the show, maybe even the villain. Who knows? But it was hard to secure her involvement, to get her attached. Again, herpes in the title, not huge. And at the time, a lot of the networks said we're not buying fish shows anymore because Fish Police was such a big disaster. Uh-huh. And I was like, that was a long time ago. People are ready for fish shows. Remember Fish, the spinoff from Barney Miller? Uh-huh. And they were like, no, we don't. No one remembers that.
I feel like tons of people are ready for fish shows. I mean, they play like multiple nights around New Year's Eve in Madison Square Garden.
Oh, right. but you're laughing to have got so mad.
So Dan, is that the end of the letter or was there more?
That's it. It was just a fun story about Piranha 3D.
Yeah, it was great.
That was well and that's
clear our palate.
That's really thank you for clearing our palate from all the from the very serious letters that came before. We might have to have a discussion with Dan about maybe just having one feeling bad about types of people letter per show.
Yeah, I mean it's called like a shit sandwich.
Okay,
where you have bread and shit and bread.
Okay, sorry.
Let's
still
next time
unpleasant.
Let's have
yeah,
that
but you wouldn't want
help me out that much.
You wouldn't want the other way around, dude. Hey. It's not like a double decker or whatever that thing is. Double deuce,
so the double down.
I got to choose between one of them. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. You have to choose the ball. It's like choosing the ball or the sword in Lone Wolf and Cub.
Okay.
Yeah, or the lady or the tiger. Keeping in mind that the lady is a lady that you don't want to talk to.
No.
Like someone at the DMV or what?
A lot of fine people work at the DMV, but yeah she does work there. Yeah, her name is Sherry. She works at the DMV.
Okay. So now's the last segment on the show. This crazy show of ours.
Dan, when was the last time you went to the DMV?
I don't know.
Okay.
Because last time I went to the DMV, the lady who was handling my case was delightful, super professional, and it didn't take very long. California DMV, ask for, I forgot her name, but she was really good.
Okay.
She was the one, you know you're in good hands when the person who's handling your case is the one everyone else is coming over to ask questions about forms they need.
Yeah.
And she has the answers. It's like, I'm in good hands. This is the expert.
Okay. Well, thank you guys for schooling me about my stereotypes.
Okay.
The DMV.
You'd think since the first two letters were literally about stereotypes, you would know not to step in.
I would think you would like the DMV because it could be like those letters could stand for Dan McCoy vehicle, you know?
They could. That's factually true.
Or Darth Murray Vader, since Murray is Darth Vader's middle name. But Dan, I know your stereotypes about the DMV come from Patty and Selma on The Simpsons. By far, the most offensive stereotype on The Simpsons, that these two ladies who work at the DMV are very unpleasant.
Wait, hold on.
Otherwise, extremely PC show.
So this last segment of the show is where we recommend movies that we saw that you should watch instead of Gotti. Please, Lord, watch anything except instead of Gotti.
Yep.
I saw two movies last night, both of which I enjoyed.
Gotti.
One was one was Under the Silver Lake, which has not been released here yet, but I have friends
who had.
Yeah,
how do you see that, Nutsack?
Friends had access to a French DVD.
Oh, I know the friend.
So it's the follow-up from the guy who did It Follows. It's a...
So this is what follows It Follows.
Yeah. Yes. Congratulations. If I were there, I would high-five you.
Yeah, put like a zinger sound effect in there. Okay.
Yeah, add in a just a zoo-zoo.
But it's nominally a mystery. I mean, it is a mystery, but like none of it makes any sense. It's kind of in the tradition of like stoner LA mysteries like The Long Goodbye or Big Lebowski, but it's much more absurd and weird and nonsensical than either of those films. Like it's about a unemployed guy played by Andrew Garfield who there's a woman who goes missing in the middle of the night who he had a moment with and he wants to find her. And he sort of becomes convinced that there are all these hidden signals around him, like that these messages that I mean, it's about the interconnectedness of all things, except for like everything that every clue that he follows up on is totally absurd and should not lead to him solving the mystery, but somehow does.
Spoiler alert.
Sorry. And so I watched that.
Hasn't even been released yet.
Yeah.
And I also saw Mausoleum, which is a great bad movie about a woman who's possessed by a demon after she goes into a mausoleum, and that's shown by her eyes turning green and her doing like crazy things with her brain powers.
Sounds awesome.
And talking about stereotypes, there is a very like minstrelly like. Lady housekeeper who gets scared of the supernatural thing in the middle of it. So that's kind of queasy, but
yeah,
the
you
rest
thought
of it,
Mausoleum would hold up.
But the rest of it is like so bad and funny and so of its time. And there's just like there's a twist ending at the end that is completely nonsensical in the most delightful way. So if you're looking for a bad movie to watch, I say Mausoleum.
Awesome. I'm going to recommend a movie. After seeing You Were Never Really Here earlier this year, I've been slowly dipping back into Lynn Ramsey's catalog, and I'm going to recommend We Need to Talk About Kevin, a spooky little joint starring Tilda Swinton, John C. Reilly, Ezra
Miller. The full quote on the poster, a spooky little joint.
Yeah, I thought it was really fun. I think it's a great little horror movie about an evil kid. It's shot beautifully. It's built around an incredible central performance by Tilda Swinton. And it bounced around in time. It postulates a universe where Tilda Swinton and John C. Reilly are married, which I love that idea. Although I don't know if I feel like their child would be even more alien than Ezra Miller, but who knows? Yeah, I like it. I also really, my favorite thing to do is to watch movies that elicit strong reactions on IMDb user reviews. And We Need to Talk About Kevin is very much like that. Apparently people thought it was based on a true story. Now, I mean, the movie uses some kind of on the nose music cues, but it worked. I don't know. Whole thing works. I like it. Watch it. Spooky kid.
Spooky little joint with a spooky kid.
Yep.
I'm gonna recommend a movie that's also it's not spooky at all, but it is haunting. Oh, I'm gonna recommend the movie First Reformed, Paul Schrader's movie with Ethan Hawke about a priest who is a reverend at a down point in his life. He is too much into alcohol, and he gets wrapped up in the life of a married couple where the husband is pretty much on his way to becoming an eco-terrorist. And the last Paul Schrader movie I tried to watch before this, Dog Eats Dog, I could not get through. Mm-hmm. But this movie I found super spellbinding and just like really disciplined and restrained in a really great way. And it feels like it's his take on Ingmar Bergman's Winterlight, which is also about a religious leader who gets traumatized basically by his experience dealing with a man who is in crisis because of larger world issues that he really has no control over, and suffers because of that loss of control. But at the same time, it's also like a companion piece to Taxi Driver in the way that Ethan Hawke's character develops over the movie. They're both about men who get very intimate looks into people's lives but have found that they can no longer connect with the world anymore. And as a result, they become radicalized in different ways. Only this one, the thing that's radicalizing him is like a real problem, which is the destruction of the environment. But I thought that Ethan Hawke was really great in it. Cedric the Entertainer has a role in it, and he's really great in it. And I've just found it to be a really powerful, affecting movie. Don't watch it looking for a good time. But at the same time,
yeah, We Need to Talk About Kevin for that. Yeah.
But it's one of these movies that came as close as I can think of to an American take on what is usually a very European type of movie, something that's grappling with religious issues in a serious way, grappling with larger forces and the way that individuals can or cannot influence the world around them in a larger way. And I just thought it was really, really well done. So First Reformed.
Yeah, no, that's being talked about for award seasons, right?
I mean, it won some Independent Spirit Awards and some Critics' Choice things it was nominated for, but I think it should – I would love it to win some awards. I think it's a really great movie. And it's the kind of movie that would be easy to dismiss as – I don't know, either too, this is too boring or too depressing or too serious or too bleak. Like, I don't care, but it's just, I found it really like powerful. And there was never a moment where I was bored with it, even when the movie was moving at its own pace. So try it out. First Reformed. Ethan Hawke. You love him. He's handsome, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, Cedric the Entertainer, he's hilarious. I mean, the part he's playing is not funny, but he's very good at it.
So three movies you can see and one movie you can't see.
Uh-huh. You know, Dan was just dangling that one in front of you to show how cool he is.
Now what do we do, Dan?
Now we say, get the fuck out of here.
Oh, wow.
Well, like a regular
John Gotti. Where was that accent earlier?
Yeah, Dan, you had so much opportunity to do your bridge and tunnel guy accent, and you just didn't do it.
Dan, I need to ask you a serious question.
Uh-huh.
What's the matter with you?
Oh, no. Marone.
Oh, wow.
Really, really, really buried the lead on this one, Dan. You're really loading up the back with all the stuff you should have done earlier.
Were you
talking
just
about Gotti.
Planning to do that one line and you were practicing the whole day in your head?
That's right.
I want to applaud my own restraint for not going into a long digression in which where I was like a Jersey guy talking about how great Gotti was.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you to me, Elliot, for not doing that and instead going with the much more profitable holes tangent.
Yeah, I love the idea that Elliot is congratulating himself on restraint.
So before we go, as always, check out MaximumFun.org for a bunch of other great shows, mm-hmm. podcasts. You like podcasts. You're listening to one right now.
Uh-huh.
Why not try
it? I mean, we don't know what your reaction is to this. You may hate it, but...
Also, if you like the show, give us a review on iTunes, tweet about us, you know,
tell your friends, tell your family, introduce it to the made men or women in your life. Let's it'd be really funny if they wanted Gotti to be more of an accepting movie. So they're like, you're now a made man or woman, as the case may be. But yeah, tweet about us, Instagram about us, Facebook about us, leave a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Flophouse, as Jan mentioned, it's a production of Maximum Fun. Go to MaximumFun.org for other great podcasts. There's lots of
don't
great
know why
ones.
You need to repeat it. I covered all this stuff. Just undermining me at this point.
Mm-hmm. Once again, get the fuck out of here. Forget about it. Marone.
Okay, all right. Well.
And I'm Dan McCoy, 2.0.
I'm Elliot Kalen.
And I'm Stuart Wellington. I guess we're ending this thing. Goodbye.
Now, here's the thing about Home Alone.
Okay.
He also had that neighbor, the scary old man with the snow shovel, who also could have come over and helped him at any time, but instead was just kind of waiting outside like a sentry. Like, as in the Judas Priest song, The Sentinel, just waiting for someone to come by so we could hit him with that shovel, right?
Yeah.
But maybe Kevin McAllister had put some sort of supernatural ward on the house that would only allow the wet bandits in, but would bar entry for any other adults. Have you thought of that?
I think that's certainly possible. I mean, I don't know what's in their basement. They already had all those cardboard cutouts and stuff. They probably have some kind of books on esoterica.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture. Artist owned.
Listener supported.